This is Silver Star Bible School 2001, our main theme being faith, hope, and love. Class 4 is entitled Seeing a Brother in Need by Brother Ken Stiles. The reading was 1 Corinthians chapter 13. Brother Ken.
We'd like to start off this afternoon, brethren and sisters, by taking a look at the events of 1 Samuel 18. Again, following the pattern to once having identified the principles of godly love, to go back now into the Old Testament and to see where these principles show up in the lives of faithful men and women. In 1 Samuel 18, following the events of the destruction of Goliath, David meets with Saul. And in verse 1 we read, "When he had finished speaking to Saul, the soul of Jonathan was knit to the soul of David, and Jonathan loved him as his own soul. And Saul took him that day and would not let him return to his father's house. Then Jonathan made a covenant with David because he loved him as his own soul. And Jonathan stripped himself of the robe that was upon him, and gave it to David, and his armor, and even his sword, and his bow and his girdle." Jonathan sees David slay Goliath in chapter 17. And then he listens to David talk to Saul about the incident. We don't know what David told Saul. But it wouldn't be surprising to learn that David shared with Saul the motivation for having taken on this giant out of his love for Yahweh and his absolute faith that this giant needed to be destroyed because he was blaspheming the God of Israel. Whatever was said, Jonathan was duly impressed by both what he had witnessed and what he heard. Because there's David with the head of Goliath to be buried in Jerusalem at the very place that Isaac was offered by Abraham, the place where sin will be defeated, the place where the temple will be built. So not only does this young man have extraordinary faith and willingness to act upon this faith, but he has an extraordinary insight into the purpose of God. And as a result of this, having seen and having heard, Jonathan's soul was knit to David's, and he loved him as his own soul. And he immediately, in the verses we just read, makes a covenant with David and gives him his robe, and his armor, even his sword, and his bow, and his girdle. But what's Jonathan doing by all these actions? He's giving David his rightful heirship to the throne. On that day, and at that moment, Jonathan was telling David, "You are our next king." And he acted in accordance with his understanding. Because Jonathan recognized that here is the one that Samuel had told my father about. Because of your disobedience, Saul, the kingdom will be taken from you and it's going to be given to another. We're not certain that Jonathan understood that. But there's no reason to believe he wouldn't have been aware of that. And Jonathan, through the covenant that he makes with David that day on the spot, becomes the first in Israel to declare his loyalty to David as Israel's future king. And the covenant bonded Jonathan to David. And it was Jonathan's acknowledgement that the throne had passed from him to David. And do you see the pieces of love that we have been talking about in our classes this week, manifested in Jonathan's actions? Here is the power of godly love at work. Because first of all, Jonathan is laying down his life for David. He's dying to sin. How? He's taking his natural desires to be the king. Who wouldn't want to be the king? He's likely been raised all his life to be the next king. It's his father's expectation that he will be the next king. And he sees the events of chapter 17, and he hears the words of chapter 18, and he responds by laying down his life and putting to death his own natural desires, willingly, for David's benefit, for the nation's benefit. This young man who was able to defeat this giant will take this nation to tremendous heights of righteousness. Jonathan can see that. And he willingly lays his life down as a result. There's Jonathan, ready and willing to lay down his life for David. And Saul is appalled when he finds out what Jonathan's true intentions are. How can you possibly, Jonathan, forego the throne for him? Jonathan is ready to lay down his life for David, and Saul will spend the rest of his life seeking to take the life of David, which shows us how far apart the two men were, the son and the father, in their willingness to embrace godly love. Saul rejected the principle of laying down your life for your brother and seeking to take it and seeking to take David's life. Just as an aside, it's one of the marvelous scenes in Scripture. You know, David will spend many years roaming the countryside as a fugitive. And what's he doing? Roaming the countryside as a fugitive, escaping one narrow encounter after another, fleeing from Saul. What is David doing? David is loving Saul. That's what he's doing. He's laying down his life for Saul, putting it at risk for Saul's benefit. And we see him do it time and time again. One of the great scenes is in the cave of En-Gedi. And we know the story when Saul goes in, and David and his men are already there in the back of the cave. And in darkness, David holds a Bible class. A Bible class. And what's the subject of the Bible class? The subject is the same subject we're studying this week. Godly love. There are his men arguing that here is the opportunity to take the life of your enemy, and God has given him into your hand. And there they are discussing godly love with their lives at stake. And David's response is, you don't stretch forth your hand against the Lord's anointed, against Yahweh's anointed. You lay down your life for your brother. You don't take his life. And it says that the word of David prevailed. He persuaded the men, as it is in the RSV. He stayed the men, as it is in the Authorized Version, with these words. And as a result of that Bible class taking place in the darkness, David and his men allow Saul to go free. That's the power of godly love in our life. But back to Jonathan. How does he crucify his flesh? By becoming a servant of David's. Saul's reaction, as we just read, to all of this, David can't go back to his father's house. David, you're mine. Jonathan's reaction, David, I'm yours. You see the difference between godly love and a life lived without it. He loves David as his own soul. The second great commandment, to love one another as yourself. The covenant he makes with David, according to chapter 20 and verse 17, is a covenant made of love. And all will be done in accordance with God's will. Jonathan isn't working outside of God's will. He hasn't defined new parameters. His love for David will exist within the parameters of God's expressed will and within the parameters of obedience to God's word. It is not human love that existed between Jonathan and David. Jonathan does all for David before David does anything for Jonathan. Jonathan's love for David is not predicated upon what David will do for him. He loves David, and he takes off his armor and gives him all that he gives him before any covenant is ever made, because his love was a godly love. It wasn't based upon what David would do for him, as is so often the case with human love. Two godly men, Jonathan and David, each living godly love. We come now to 1 Corinthians chapter 12. We know the background. The Spirit gifts are plentiful in Corinth, and they are causing no end of problems for the ecclesia. It appears from verse 1 of chapter 12 that the Corinthians had written to Paul, inquiring into the Spirit gifts and their purpose and how they should be used and how to resolve some of the problems that had arisen. So in chapter 12, Paul recounts the purpose of the gifts, saying in verse 7, "To each is given the manifestation of the Spirit to the withal, or for the common good." That was the purpose of the Spirit gifts, to benefit all in the ecclesia. The gifts were being misused. Their purpose was misunderstood. And they were seen to be far more important in the eyes and in the minds of many in Corinth than they were ever intended to be. They were seen to be the final objective of what God was working in the ecclesia. And Paul has to point out that that was not the case. They're causing divisions instead of edifying. And we know from the first chapter of the first letter of Corinthians that they were given to these divisions within the body. So Paul uses in chapter 12 the analogy of the one body to illustrate the need for the ecclesia to be working together, to see themselves as a single unified body of believers. There's no place, he says, for self-imposed isolation in an ecclesia. The foot can't say, because I'm not a hand, I'm just going to go live over here and hardly participate, because I'm not the right kind of member, and I'll just leave the ecclesia to everyone else. Nor, Paul says, can the ecclesia impose separation or exclusion. The eye can't say to the hand, I don't need you. Or the head to the feet, we won't be needing you now. The body needs to all work together. There was a need for diversity within the ecclesia. All the parts, all the members, Paul says, are important. It wouldn't be a body if they were all the same part. And for those parts that are weak, they need to be bestowed with greater honor. Why had God arranged all of this in verse 25? That there be no schism or discord in the body, but that the members may have the same care for one another. So the purpose was twofold, to avoid schism or division within the ecclesia, and that secondly, all the members would be cared for, and each of the members would care for each other. So this was the divine model of what our ecclesias should be based upon. And the Spirit gifts were given with the intent that this model would be supported, but they had become a source of contention, a source of self-exaltation, And they weren't edifying, at least in Corinth. So, and it's easy to see how a brother with the gift of speaking in tongues could disrupt an ecclesia if he used that for his own self-glorification. It would create quite a stir to be able to have that gift. And it would detract from the purpose of the ecclesia. So he concludes chapter 12 by stating that while God had given various responsibilities within the ecclesia, it was important that the members of the ecclesial body all be in support of one another. And in verse, at the end of chapter 12, we read, "But earnestly desire the higher or the better or the best gifts." In other words, desire those gifts that will best edify this multi-member body. And now in chapter 13, Paul is saying, look, the Spirit gifts were not the final objective of God. There's a higher objective. I want to raise you, Corinthians, and I want to raise your spiritual expectations of yourselves to a higher level, because there is a more excellent way for the ecclesia to work in unity and to work in harmony. They had thought that the Spirit gifts were the pinnacle of discipleship, and he says, no, it's godly love that is the pinnacle of discipleship. The Spirit gifts had been preoccupying their minds and their thoughts. And Paul says, leave that behind. What should be preoccupying yourselves is your spiritual development, the development of your character based upon the Word working in your lives. And so chapter 13 is devoted to raising their spiritual sights to something that is better than the Spirit gifts, to practicing godly love. And we don't have the problem of Spirit gifts today in our ecclesias. But we do have the problem of brethren and sisters in ecclesias being able to get along with one another. Ecclesial disharmony, ecclesial dysfunctionality is a serious problem that we face today. And chapter 13 addresses that very issue, because Paul describes how godly love is the answer to ecclesial disharmony. It is the answer to dysfunctional ecclesias. And for any of us that are responsible for our ecclesia working in harmony, which includes everyone from the arranging brethren to every sister, to every young person who is now a member of the ecclesia, having been baptized, to the person who may have just joined the ecclesia last week, we all share a responsibility in the body working together as one. Godly love, Paul says, will get each of the parts working together so that the entire body is edified. And the principles of chapter 13 reach beyond just an ecclesia, because it stretches as well into the relationships between two brethren or between two ecclesias. The solution, he says, is for all members to commit themselves to living godly love. In chapter 13, then, we see what the gospel is intended to bring us to. It's what godly love looks like when it has taken a hold of our life. We spent several classes this week talking about why godly love exists, and the love of the Father and the love of the Son. Well, here in chapter 13 is what godly love is intended to look like in our life. If Hebrews 11 is a description of what faith will lead us to, 1 Corinthians 13 is a description of what godly love will lead us to in our walk. In verse 1, Paul goes right at the problem. And you notice Paul is an excellent person to be writing this chapter, because he has the Spirit gifts. And he's able to tell them, look, the answer is not in Spirit gifts. The answer is in godly love. If I speak in the tongues of men and of angels, but have not love, I am a noisy gong or a clanging cymbal. To have the Spirit gifts, he says, without practicing godly love was worse than being meaningless. It was obnoxious to have the Spirit gifts without godly love. It's as if one was standing in the corner, clanging on a cymbal, blowing a trumpet incessantly. Paul says that's what the Spirit gifts are without godly love. His point was, if you don't first have love, don't try to use your Spirit gift in the ecclesia, because it won't be helpful to the body. Everyone would be better off if you remain silent. You see, godly love was to be developed apart from the Spirit gifts. You didn't need the Spirit gifts to develop godly love, because not all had the Spirit gifts. It was the principles of the Word taking root, producing a different fruit in our life than what fruit would be developed by the natural way of life. And verse 2 is the danger. You know, we consider and say, well, we don't have the spirit gifts, so we don't have that danger of standing in the corner and sounding like a noisy cymbal. But we do have the danger of verse 2. If I have prophetic powers and understand all mysteries and all knowledge, and if I have all faith so as to remove mountains, but have not love, I am nothing. And he paints an extreme situation where knowledge exists without love. And this extreme situation says a brother could have the gift of prophecy to understand all mysteries and all knowledge and the gift of faith to do great miracles, and this brother could know everything, literally everything about the Word, and he could understand everything that he knows, and he could believe everything that he understands that he knows. But if he hath not love, despite all his knowledge and all his understanding and all his belief, Paul says he is nothing. Knowledge and understanding is not the end of discipleship. The end of discipleship, what God is looking for, is godly love. So we can gain great knowledge, and Paul says we can be worthless in God's eyes, of no spiritual value to him. And this isn't intended in a demeaning way. These are Paul's words. If we have the knowledge without the understanding that leads to love, it is meaningless. It is valueless for God to be able to use us to work in his ecclesia. The same principle that we've been seeing this week. We need to take what we learn and we need to put it into practice so that our love can grow. God has tremendous expectations of each of us this week. He is exposing us to principles in his word, in allowing our knowledge to increase and our understanding for a purpose. So we will take this and add to it godly love and go out and live what we're learning. As an example, whenever we assemble for Bible classes, even to do the daily readings, this principle of knowledge leading to godly love needs to be right there with us. If love is the intended outcome of our knowledge, then we can't leave the daily readings. We can't leave the Bible class without having first identified what is this knowledge intended to bring me to in terms of godly love. In Revelation 1 and 3, we know the divine model that we need to hear and we need to know and we need to keep. The keeping part is the loving part. It's of no good to us if we have the hearing and the knowing part without the keeping. So brethren, when we're preparing Bible classes back home and we're developing our thoughts and our material and we're developing exhortations, any time we're going to feed the flock and undertake that responsibility, we need to also be developing in our thoughts and in the material that we'll present. We need to present the godly love part of the knowledge that we're sharing. Because if our brethren and sisters are leaving the Bible class and they cannot connect the knowledge with the godly love, because in our studies of the Word we did not connect the knowledge that we have acquired with how this is intended to lead us to godly love, Paul says we are nothing, because the knowledge is intended to lead us to godly love. Until the Word shows up in how we live, it hasn't had the intended impact. If our members are not being edified because we have not shown them the path to love from the knowledge we've provided, then we are not fulfilling our responsibility as the ecclesial shepherds. Verse 3 is a warning about doing without love, corresponding to the warning of verse 2 about knowing without love. If I give away all that I have to feed the poor, as it is in the Authorized Version, and if I deliver my body to be burned, but have not love, I gain nothing. Again, he's citing an extreme example. I can give away everything that I own, and then I can give my body to be burned. And he's not denigrating generosity. And he's not denigrating the principle we've been looking at about laying down our life for one another. But he's warning us that it's possible to do it without love. It's possible to have the appearance of righteousness, but it's all being done for the wrong reasons. Because you can give away all that you have, and you can give your body to be burned, he says, without love, without the fruit of righteousness taking hold and being shown in the giving to others based upon a godly love. Because the thinking of the flesh is so deceitful that he uses two extremes. I can be a perfect giver. I can take everything I own and I can give it away. And then I can turn around and give my body to be burned. I have nothing left to give. I've given all of my goods away, and now I've given of myself to be burned, and there's nothing left to give. And what does Paul say it is? It's nothing if it is done without love. And the sober warning, once again, is that we can give and we can do an immense amount in the truth. Paul is warning me I can spend a lifetime in the truth. And if I do it without love, I have gained nothing. It's not the giving and doing that God is looking for. That doesn't determine whether or not we have love. The giving and the doing needs to come as a result of the love. The love must come first. It must be at the foundation of our works, the foundation of our obedience. Otherwise, it's the works of the flesh. And here is where faith and love share a common thread. Because the works done without either, sorry, works can be done without either. Works can be done without faith. Works can be done without love. In both cases, it's to the person's glory, not to God's glory. So put Paul's caution from verses 2 and 3 together with the caution that we saw from John yesterday in 1 John 3. And it's a bit of a sobering picture. Because Paul is saying, don't assume that love is automatically the motive of what you do, because it may not be. And he's warning us, as John warned us. You know, yesterday we saw John said that we can say we have love, but not do it. This is not godly love, because God's love doesn't abide in us. Now Paul is saying, not only can we say we have love, we can then do everything there is to do. But if we still don't have love in the doing, then that is not godly love. So how do we know if in our doing and in our giving for others, we really have godly love, and we're simply not being deceived by ourselves in all our doing and all our giving? And the answer is in verses 4 to 7. Because this is what godly love looks like in a person who is being motivated by it. It's how it acts. It's how it doesn't act. It's regardless of the situation it finds itself in. And it's not a complicated subject. These attributes in verses 4, 5, 6, and 7 are concepts that our Sunday school scholars can easily begin to grasp. From a positive standpoint, what godly love is and what it does is it's patient and kind. It rejoices in the truth. It bears all things. It believes all things. It hopes all things. It endures all things. And it never stops. It never fails. It keeps on giving and keeps on doing. From a negative standpoint, what godly love is not, or what it doesn't do, is it's not envious. It's not boastful. It's not proud. It's not rude. It doesn't seek its own advantage. It's not easily provoked. It doesn't think evil. It doesn't rejoice in iniquity. So when we find ourselves reflecting these qualities in our life, the ones we ought to be, and avoiding those characteristics that we ought not to be reflecting, then Paul says we will know that we have godly love. And this is not a definition that is in opposition to the laying down of our life for one another. But this is a more practical, a more detailed examination of what godly love looks like. You could insert the word Christ, as some brethren have done, for the word love or charity in these four verses. And there's a picture of the life of Christ and the character of Christ, because his life was one of manifesting God's love. Love is kind, Paul says, and the Greek word means to be useful or to be helpful to others. And this isn't just a warm smile or a word of encouragement on Sunday morning or at the Bible class. If you turn over to Ephesians 4, we find that Paul connects kindness with forgiveness in verse 32. And be kind, he says, to one another. Tender-hearted, forgiving one another as God in Christ forgave you. So it isn't just a word of encouragement. Kindness, as a characteristic of godly love, will forgive a brother or sister who has sinned against us. So if you want to show kindness to someone, don't just open the door for them on Sunday morning.